Dynamic, articulate, perceptive, courageous, outspoken. Just a few of the adjectives that so inadequately describe Malcolm X. Few singular personalities have emerged on the national and international scene to so excite and stimulate interest in the plight of 22 million Afro-Americans in the USA. Controversial? Without a doubt. Not only speaking out the agonies of 22 million members of the black masses, but effectively voicing the guarded views and opinions of many of his detractors in the Negro elite. Indeed, Malcolm X Speaks Again is particularly timely as the spirit and status of this great human, even after physical death, continues to live and grow. We are privileged to again hear the voice of Minister Malcolm X.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome the opportunity to come into your home.
Sir, I would like to know what your position is on nonviolence.
Well, nonviolence is one of the things that has disarmed the so-called Negro here in America. And any Negro leader who teaches our people to be nonviolent in the face of the violence that we've been experiencing for the past 400 years is actually doing our people a disservice. In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime for any Negro leader to teach our people not to do something to protect ourselves, especially in the face of the violence that is inflicted upon us by the white people here in America. And whenever you teach a man to turn the other cheek or to be nonviolent, what you're actually doing is disarming the victim of white brutality. You're robbing him of his right to defend himself. In fact, the only time it's intelligent to be nonviolent is when you're dealing with someone else who's nonviolent. I'm nonviolent with those who are nonviolent with me. This is intelligent. But just as you see other people doing whatever is necessary to protect themselves, it's time today for the 22 million Afro-Americans to feel free to do whatever is necessary to protect ourselves. Take for an example, in the Constitution, it gives a person the right to have a rifle or a shotgun. And in areas in this country where the government has proven itself either unwilling or unable to defend the black people, it is time for the black man to stand up and start defending himself. Not to go out and initiate acts of aggression against whites or initiate acts of aggression against anyone, but in areas where we see that the government will not protect us or defend us or find those who have brutalized us and made us the victims for the past 400 years, then it is time for us to do whatever is necessary to defend ourselves. And it should be emphasized that by this, I don't mean that we should go out and look for trouble or start trouble or initiate acts of aggression. But we should feel that we're within our human rights, our civil rights, and within the rights of intelligence to do whatever is necessary when we are attacked to defend ourselves. In fact, the best thing to teach our people is never to be the aggressor, never to look for trouble. But anytime anyone makes any effort to brutalize us or to inflict wounds upon us, we should feel that we are within our rights to do whatever is necessary to repel them. Do nothing unto anyone, but always do whatever is necessary to keep others from doing to you which they've been doing for the past 400 years, making us the victims of brutality.
But is it not a fact, Minister, that people like Dr. Martin Luther King, who have advocated nonviolence, have been successful with their nonviolent moves?
Well, they've been successful in going to jail. They've been successful in becoming the victims of police dogs and police clubs and water hoses. If Dr. Martin Luther King feels that this is the best way to gain freedom, justice, and equality for our people in this country, well and good. I have no criticism of him whatsoever, but I think that the time has come now where the masses of black people feel that nonviolence shouldn't be taught to us unless it's also taught to the white people in this country. And black people shouldn't be taught to turn the other cheek unless the white people are taught to turn the other cheek. Now, if Dr. Martin Luther King can be so successful in disarming Negroes, they should send him to Russia and let him disarm the Russians. Let him disarm some of these other countries where...
That may sound good in philosophy, Minister Malcolm, but I still have to take the stand that Dr. King has been a degree successful with the violence movement. Now, let's take the March on Washington, for instance. Was this not something that exemplified the feeling of the Negro and made everyone very, very happy?
It depends on whether or not anything was gotten out of it. In fact, yes, it probably made them happy. Most of the people I saw involved in the March on Washington looked very, very happy. In fact, they looked too happy to be involved in a Negro revolt. So that insofar as the March on Washington producing meaningful results, most of the masses of black people today and this year are beginning to see where nothing came of it other than the fact that it gave many of the bourgeois Negroes a chance to feel that they were doing something without really having to do anything. It became a status symbol, just like going to the Kentucky Derby is a status symbol for those who know nothing about horses. They like to be able to say they went to the Kentucky Derby and they can't tell a horse from a cow. Or the Rose Bowl game, they like to be able to say they went to the Rose Bowl game and they don't know a football from a baseball. But the fact that they can say they went to the Rose Bowl game is a status symbol. Or the fact that they can say they went to the Kentucky Derby is a status symbol. So many Negroes took the opportunity to say that they were in the March on Washington. Not that it produced anything, or not that they really felt that they were involved in a Negro revolution, but it gave them a chance to say, I was there. It was a status symbol. But status symbols don't take us out of the alleys and out of the ghettos and out of the slums. Status symbols don't remove segregated school systems. Status symbols don't get meaningful civil rights legislation. So when it comes to the March on Washington and all of these other nonviolent approaches, they were good in their day. But this is a new day, and it's a new Negro.
But we will have to agree, Minister Malcolm, that the March on Washington was the forerunner to the creation of, or at least to the presentment of, the Civil Rights Bill. Without this type of approach, I doubt seriously that the Civil Rights Bill would have even been entered onto the floor.
A horse can enter into the race and come so far from the finish line that you don't even know that that horse was in the race. And since the March on Washington was designed to produce meaningful civil rights legislation, and if I recall, I heard several of the leaders of it point out that we'll be back if the bill meets with any kind of opposition come September. They said this in August. Now, September passed, and the bill, it didn't even come up. October passed, November passed, December passed, the year passed, everything passed, and the bill hasn't been passed yet.
Are you saying that you feel a more violent approach to it would cause this bill to be passed, Minister
Malcolm?
It's not
a case of violence, and I think that our people should never let themselves be trapped intellectually into thinking that whenever they do something to defend themselves against the violence of the white man, that they're being violent.
But you're advocating violence, aren't
you? No, we're advocating the necessity of black people defending themselves against the violence of the white man, because the American government has already proven itself either unable or unwilling to defend us, as it should do.
Well, the white man hasn't gone out to create any marches, nor has he gone out to do anything that would make the people in the communities feel that he was opposed by law to their thinking.
No, all he has done is sicked his police dogs on innocent black women and babies. All he has done is put his fire hoses on innocent women and children, black women and children.
That's right. That's right.
Or all he has done is shoot Medgar Evers in the back.
Right.
Or he has bombed the church in Birmingham, Alabama, and murdered four innocent little girls.
That's right.
Or he has shot down young boys from their bicycle as they were riding innocently through the street.
That's right.
That's all he has done.
That's right.
Well, you feel that this is a cause for the Negro to take on the violent act?
It's not a case of the Negro taking on a violent act, but it's a case of the Negro doing what is necessary to defend himself against the violent acts of the whites,
right. Since
the government has refused to defend the Negro. The church was bombed, and the government has done nothing about it. Medgar Evers was murdered, and the government has done nothing about it. Emmett Till and Charles Mack Parker were murdered, and the government has done nothing about it. But at the same time, the government is in South Vietnam, trying to tell them what to do. The government is in Berlin trying to tell them what to do. The government is in Africa trying to tell them what to do. But it cannot get its own people here in Mississippi and Alabama and New York City and tell them what to do.
Mr. Malcolm X discusses human or civil rights.
Minister Malcolm, I'd like to know why you place so much emphasis on calling the freedom struggle among Afro-Americans in this country a struggle for human rights rather than civil rights.
Well, most of our people don't even know the meaning of civil rights, and by not knowing what it is they're actually trying to get, it has eluded us for the past 100 years. Civil rights is supposed to mean citizenship. When you have civil rights, you have citizenship. When you have citizenship, you have civil rights. And if the 22 million Afro-Americans were actually citizens of this country, it wouldn't be necessary to pass any kind of additional legislation to include us in the Constitution. If you notice, whenever the people come here from Europe, they can come here from Poland, which is a communist country. They don't need any legislation to make this Polish person a citizen. They don't need any additional civil rights legislation to make the refugees from Hungary who come here citizens. They don't need any additional legislation to make anyone who comes to this country a citizen. But when it comes to the rights of the black people who are the descendants of slaves, then immediately new legislation is necessary. So this right here implies that when the Constitution was written, in some way or other, it must have excluded those of us who were slaves at that time. And because we were excluded from the Constitution when it was originally written, today they have to amend it in order to include us. But if you notice, the Civil War didn't include us in the Constitution. Had the Civil War included us in the Constitution, we would be citizens today. Had the amendments even to the Constitution actually included us, we would be citizens today. If the Supreme Court desegregation decision way back in 1954 was sufficient to include us into the jurisdiction of the Constitution, all of our problems would be solved today. So there's something about civil rights that makes it almost impossible for us to get it. So you have to know the difference between civil rights and human rights. As long as our people are begging for civil rights, or they are labeling their struggle for freedom, justice, and equality under the label of civil rights, then what they do is leave us in the jurisdiction of Uncle Sam's courts. And it's actually Uncle Sam who is guilty of all of the violation of our rights that have taken place in this country. So when you go to Uncle Sam to try and get some kind of redress over civil rights violations, you're taking your case to the man who's responsible for the violation. So the only way our people can really get some meaningful results, it has to be taken out of Uncle Sam's hand and taken into a world court. And the world court that has been set up to listen to the complaints of human rights violations is in the United Nations. Human rights are international, and civil rights come within the jurisdiction of the country where these rights are violated. Some people may wonder why our brothers from Africa and Asia have not spoken out more boldly or without compromise on the injustices that the 22 million Afro-Americans experience in this country. They can't speak out. As long as these injustices are labeled by us as civil rights, then this remains a domestic issue, and none of our people from abroad, because of protocol, can become involved in Uncle Sam's domestic problems. So all the civil rights groups have to do is expand the struggle from civil rights to human rights. And once it is expanded to the level of human rights, then this puts us in a position to charge Uncle Sam with violating the UN Charter on Human Rights. We can take it before the United Nations, and other nations of this earth can then side with us and indict Uncle Sam for the mistreatment of 22 million Afro-Americans. The very fact that the struggle of the black people in South Africa, or I should say the injustices that have been experienced by black people in South Africa has come before the UN, or the injustices experienced by our own people again in Angola has been brought before the UN. Even the oppression of the Hungarians has been brought before the UN. The plight of the Jews in Soviet Russia, and there's only 3 million of them in Russia, has been brought before the UN. Well, then why hasn't the problem of the 22 million Afro-Americans come before the United Nations? It has not come before them because the leaders of the civil rights struggle don't understand what civil rights actually amount to. When they are mature to the point where they can see that their present struggle has kept them under Uncle Sam's jurisdiction, and Uncle Sam is not morally capable of solving this problem, then they will shift it out of the courts of Uncle Sam and take it to the courts of the United Nations on the level of human rights, and we'll get some kind of meaningful results. Right. As long as we keep it at the civil rights level, we alienate the support of our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia. But when we shift it to the level of human rights, we have the support of billions of black, brown, red, and yellow people from all over this earth behind us.
The United States is a great world power and has in the past exercised a lot of control and power within the United Nations. So how can you expect to wage a successful battle against such a powerful country in a world court?
Well, whenever you believe in what the United States has taught us concerning democracy, which means one voice, one vote, this is good, because in the present world setup,
world governmental setup, as is represented by the United Nations, each country there has one vote, which means that no matter how wealthy a nation is, it only has one vote. And no matter how poor a nation is, it still has one vote. So the ballot actually equalizes the poor man and the rich man. Back when the United Nations was set up, it consisted largely of white nations, because most of the dark nations were then colonized and weren't independent. Since the dark nations have gained their independence and have emerged on the scene, today in the UN you have more dark nations who are in a position to vote in a bloc than you have white nations. So that we have a situation now where the grouping together of the dark nations who formerly were colonized has given them enough political power to offset the military power and prestige of these mighty white nations of the West. And it is their support. It is only in the United Nations, where everyone has the ballot, where everyone has equal vote, that the plight of the black man can be given a just hearing and the weight of the dark world can be come down on our side and balance the scales on our side. But whenever you take it into the white man's court, you never will get justice, because the white man is the guilty one who committed the crime in the first place. Right. It's like taking your case from the wolf to the fox to take it to Washington, D.C.
I don't think I wholeheartedly go along with that, Mr. Malcolm. I have some appreciation for your discussion as regards to human right and the civil right. But here in America, as a band of Negroes, I think the most progressive thinking that we could possibly attain is civil rights. This is the thing that we want. This is the thing that we hope to get. This is the thing that we're going out to fight for. Without our civil rights, the human rights and the rest of the elements are non-entities as far as
human rights come before civil rights. Human
that
rights.
May be so, but the civil rights are an important factor.
You can never get civil rights until you have human rights. Human rights represent the right to be a human being. Whenever you are respected and recognized as a human being, your civil rights are automatic.
But if we get civil rights, we are human beings.
No,
we progress
you, have,
human
no
beings.
You have to get the recognition of human rights first. This is why people can come here from Africa and Asia and immediately are able to benefit from what the Constitution stands for, because they are recognized as a human being when they touch the shores of North America. But the black people in this country, all of our human characteristics were destroyed by slavery. Our language was destroyed. Our history was destroyed. Our culture was destroyed. And then the white man taught us that we were savages in the jungle and living at a subhuman level. And for this reason, when they put the Constitution together, they classified our people as three-fifths of a man, which meant subhuman, not a complete human being. And once our human characteristics were completely destroyed, this gave them justification for treating us like we were animals. And then, and it also justified their selling us from plantation to plantation like you sell a horse and a cow and a bag of wheat. Why, George Washington himself, historically, is on record as having sold or having traded a black man for a keg of molasses, which shows you he didn't regard that black man as a human being. Well, if the black man's human rights had been respected, he never could have been a slave here in America. And if his human rights had been restored by the Emancipation Proclamation, automatically we would have been citizens right after the Civil War. So we must be regarded as humans. Our human rights must be respected before we can ever be regarded as citizens and our civil rights be respected.
Sunday, September 15th, in the year of our Lord, 1963. It was a cool, overcast morning in Birmingham, Alabama. Sunday school classes were just ending in the basement of the 50-year-old yellow brick church. The morning's lesson was The Love That Forgives, the fifth chapter of Matthew. Outside, parents were arriving to collect the children. At 22 minutes past the hour of 10, a force let loose that electrified and shook the world. Great chunks of stone shot out like artillery through parked cars. A metal railing tore from its concrete bed and shot across the street into the window of the social dry cleaning store. Customers in the next door Silver Springs restaurant were knocked to the floor. Inside the church, someone yelled,
"Lie on the floor, everybody, lie on the floor!"
Rafters collapsed. The skylight fell on the pulpit. Part of a stained glass window shattered, obliterating the face of Christ.
"Everybody out, move out, out quickly!"
Children stumbled through litter and twisted metal, broken chairs, splintered wooden benches, shredded hymn books and Bibles. Police cars sirened into the block. Workers, barehanded, dug deeper into the rubble and uncovered the bodies of four little girls. The church pastor, the Reverend John Cross, urged the people to go home.
"Please go home. Go home, everybody. The Lord is our shepherd. We shall not want."
"We give them love and we get this."
The Birmingham Police Department's six-wheel riot tank entered the area and cops commenced firing shotguns over the Negroes' heads to rock-throwing retaliation. Young boys started stoning passing cars with white passengers. Police ordered them to stop. One 16-year-old boy ran. A cop killed him with a buckshot blast. September 15, 1963. 19 hurt, 5 dead.
This didn't happen in Nazi Germany, and it didn't happen in South Africa. It happened right here in America, in Birmingham, Alabama. It didn't happen back in the Dark Ages. It happened in 1963, right after the March on Washington. And it wasn't a dream. This was a nightmare. Where were the leaders? Where was America? Where was the government?
Minister Malcolm, who was guilty of the bombing in Birmingham?
The government was guilty. The guilt is upon the United States government for the murder of those four little girls who died in that bombing. The guilt was upon the United States government for those little boys who were shot down right afterwards, because it is the failure of the government to do its job that has given the people of that area the feeling that they can brutalize and victimize and murder the Afro-American in cold blood, knowing that nothing will be done about it. The government was guilty. The government still is guilty. The murderers of those little girls have been brought to justice.
Minister Malcolm, do you feel that the government, as charged being guilty, should inject themselves into this? There seems to be some technicality as to the fact that they can't get into this due to the fact that this is a state as against government opposition, where the legal matter of it is concerned.
Well, it has become impossible for the government in Washington, D.C. to intercede, because if you study the structure of the United States government, you'll find that out of 16 senatorial committees that govern this country, 10 of them are in the hands of the senators who are nothing but Southern segregationists. Out of the 20 congressional committees that govern the country, 12 of them are in the hands of congressmen who are nothing but Southern segregationists. So we can see that the government itself in Washington, D.C., is a segregationist government. And they teach you and me that the South lost the Civil War. But at the same time, when we examine the structure of the government, we find that it is run by white racists, by white supremacists, by segregationists who are called Dixocrats but are actually nothing but Democrats, whose leader is sitting in the White House, who himself is also a former senator from a segregationist racist state known as Texas.
Well, this may be true, but this does not hamper the fact, Minister Malcolm, that there is a legal procedure. Now, in these bombings, and the question is, who is guilty of them?
They didn't have to worry about a legal procedure when they wanted to send troops into South Vietnam. They didn't worry about legal procedures when they wanted to send their troops into Cuba and tell the Cubans what to do. Uncle Sam has never worried about legality whenever he wanted to send his troops wherever his interests were threatened. But when it comes to protecting the lives of 22 million Afro-Americans, then all of a sudden Uncle Sam becomes very conscious of legality.
Well, isn't it a fact that they did send soldiers into Birmingham, Alabama, and on the perimeter they were held?
I think you'll find that for several weeks, when Dr. Martin Luther King and his cohorts were the victim of cattle prods and water hoses and vicious police dogs in Birmingham, they were calling upon Washington, D.C. to come to their rescue. And the only word that they got out of Washington was that no stature had been violated that would allow Washington to intercede, to inject itself into that dispute. But as long as the Negroes in Birmingham, Alabama were being nonviolent and were turning the other cheek, then there was nothing the government in Washington could do about it. As long as brutal attack, the government in Washington professed that it could do nothing about it.
But on that night, when the Negroes exploded, that Saturday night, and began to react against the whites who had been brutalizing them, then the government in Washington, D.C. sent troops in. And they didn't send troops in to protect the Negroes, because Negroes had been the victims of brutality for several weeks. They sent troops into Birmingham, Alabama, only when the lives and the property of the white racists and segregationists in Alabama were being threatened.
But specifically as regards to the church, the bombing, and the children, of course, which was an atrocity beyond belief, the government, in all fairness, is not able to fight that case in that it happened within the city and its city government, state government.
Well, the government saw fit to send the football coach down to investigate it. And since when do governments send football coaches to investigate atrocities?
Right.
Whenever this same government sees its interest being threatened in Cyprus or threatened in the Congo or threatened in the Middle East, they look for diplomats of international stature.
Right.
But these same diplomats who are sent abroad to settle the differences of other people, if they were sent into Georgia or Alabama or Mississippi, why, they would hang that diplomat on a tree.
Right.
Well, don't you think that Dr. King and all the rest of the very wonderful leaders throughout the state of Alabama, don't you think that they have tried and made sufficient enough effort in the handling of this case?
Well, Dr. King and many of the other wonderful leaders who are in the South and other parts of the country have been doing the best that they could, but the odds against them are so great on the part of the white racists and the white supremacists, and they work in conjunction with many of the white racists here in the North who pose as liberals, so we can see today that it is almost impossible for Dr. King to win. So we're going to need some help on a broader scale from a more powerful source.
What source do you think that this particular help is needed from?
As our darker brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia, in Latin America, awaken and become enlightened and emerge and get their independence and are able to get in positions of power, they look here in America and see the plight of their little darker brother, the 22 million Afro-Americans. And as they see our plight and their sympathy and feeling for us increases, sooner or later, some kind of move has to be made to bring an end to this unjust situation that 22 million Afro-Americans find ourselves confronted by here in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Gentlemen, Minister Malcolm X discusses the ballot or bullet.
Minister Malcolm, what do you mean by the ballot or the bullet?
Well, as our people, the Afro-Americans, become politically mature, they become very much aware of the recent trend in political elections. They see that every time there's an election recently, there's always a recount, that whites are so evenly divided politically that in many areas, the race is so close that they have to count the votes all over again to see who got in office. You had a recount where the governor was concerned in Massachusetts or in Minnesota or in Rhode Island, and the same thing was so close between President Kennedy and Nixon that they had to count the votes all over again. And our people are beginning to see this, and they also realize that any minority group that has a block of votes is able to determine who'll be the next mayor, or who'll be the next governor, or who'll be the next president, or who'll be the next congressman or the next senator. And this enables them to see the strategic position that they're in. Also, they realize that it was the black vote that put the present administration in Washington, D.C. It was the black vote here in America that put a Democratic administration in Washington, D.C., and despite the fact that it is admitted by the students of political science that the 22 million Afro-Americans were the ones who put the present administration in power in Washington, D.C., the present administration has put us last. We put them first, but they put us last. And you may say, well, why do I say this? Because they've been down there for 4 years and are only just now getting around to civil rights legislation or doing something about the violation of the civil rights of the 22 million Afro-Americans who put them in power. Now, despite the fact that they claim that they can do nothing about this, when you look at the structure of the senators and the congressmen in Washington, D.C., or the two political parties, we can see where the congressmen are concerned, 257 of them are Democrats, and only 177 of them are Republicans. That means that the Democratic Party controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives, and where the senators are concerned, there are 67 Democratic senators and only 33 Republicans that controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives and also controls two-thirds of the Senate. And despite the fact that they control two-thirds of the House and the Senate, and are able to pass all the other type of legislation that comes up, when it comes to the rights of the black people in this country who put them in power, they always have some kind of alibi to give the Negro to try and explain why they have not been able to deliver or keep their promises or the promises that they made when they were running for office. And the alibi that they usually use is they say that the Dixocrats tie things up.
Well, there was a time when black people were politically immature that they thought it was the Dixocrats that were keeping the Democrats from fulfilling their promise. But today, as Negroes become politically mature, they can see that a Dixocrat is nothing but a Democrat in disguise. That you've got to be a Democrat before you can be a Dixocrat. And as our people begin to see this, they also are able to see that it is actually a coalition of Southern Democrats along with the Northern Democrats who actually play a giant political con game to make them at the same time they are not. A good example of this, recently when I was in Washington, D.C., watching the senators filibuster, I noticed that in the back of the Senate room, there was a huge map on the wall showing the states where most of the Negroes live. And in each one of those states where the majority of the Negroes were living, the senator from that state was involved in a filibuster, which meant that he had the filibuster in order to keep those Negroes from getting voting rights. Because as soon as the Negroes in the southern states get voting rights, they will vote out of office the present racist segregationists who are posing as senators in Washington, D.C. And once the Negro gets the vote and he can oust these southern senators and southern congressmen, then that means the present committees that govern the direction that this government takes in its foreign and domestic policy will be changed because the committee chairman will be changed. And in many instances, they'll have a black senator or a black congressman. The including of black people into the governmental system automatically will mean that the political philosophy of the government will change. The political direction of the government will change. And it will have an effect upon the economy of this particular country. In fact, the 22 million Afro-Americans are in a position to bring about a bloodless revolution where America is concerned, because if America gives complete voting rights and voting power to every person on this continent, it will include overnight a block of 22 million Afro-Americans who have a unique political and economic philosophy. So this means that America, for the first time in history, represents a country that can actually involve itself in a bloodless revolution. All other revolutions in history have been bloody. The Russian Revolution was bloody. The Chinese Revolution was bloody. The French Revolution was bloody. The Cuban Revolution was bloody. Revolutions historically are always bloody. Now, America is in a unique position to involve herself in a bloodless revolution by giving the 22 million Afro-Americans the ballot. And if they don't give the 22 million Afro-Americans the ballot and make possible a bloodless revolution, then they are going to force the Afro-Americans to use the bullet. And it will be a bloody revolution. And this is what I meant when I say the ballot or the bullet. It's the same thing that Patrick Henry meant when he said liberty or death.
Gentlemen, Minister Malcolm X discusses black nationalism.
Minister Malcolm, since nationalism was able to put approximately 35 nations of our black brothers in the United Nations, how long do you think it will take to solve the problem of 22 million Afro-Americans economically, politically, socially in America?
Well, it's true. Just as it took nationalism to bring about freedom for our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia, it'll take the gospel of black nationalism to bring freedom to the 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country. And we who belong to the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, although Islam is our religious philosophy, our political, economic, and social philosophy is black nationalism. And we adopt this philosophy so that we can work with all other leaders and all other organizations in a program that everybody can become involved in and participate in order to eliminate the political, social, and economic evils that afflict our people. Now, the political philosophy of black nationalism only means that the black man should control the politics and the politicians in his own community. And the politicians must also be made to take the responsibility for helping to eliminate the evils that afflict our people in our own community. And the economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that our people need to be re-educated into the importance of controlling the economy of our own community, controlling the economy of the community in which we live. And by controlling the economy of the community in which we live, it means that we have to learn how to own and operate the businesses of our community and develop them into some type of industry that will enable us to create employment for the people of our community so that they won't have to constantly be involved in picketing and boycotting other people in other communities in order to get a job. Also, in line with this economic philosophy of black nationalism, in order for us to control the economy of our own community, we have to learn the importance of spending our money in the community where we live. Anyone who knows the basic principles of economics must be aware of the fact that when you take the money out of the neighborhood in which you live, and spend it in an integrated neighborhood, or rather in your effort to integrate, you spend it in a neighborhood where you don't live. The neighborhood in which you spend your money becomes wealthier and wealthier, and the neighborhood out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And this is one of the reasons why wherever you find Negroes, a slum condition usually develops, or we have to live in the ghetto, because all of our wealth is spent elsewhere. And even when we try and spend the money in the neighborhood where we live, usually because we haven't learned the importance of owning and operating businesses, the businesses of our community are usually also controlled by outsiders. The stores are controlled by people who don't even live in our community. So even when we try and spend our money in the neighborhood where we live, we're spending it with someone who puts it in a basket and takes it out as soon as the sun goes down. So the economic philosophy of black nationalism puts the burden upon the black man of learning how to control his own economy. And the social philosophy of black nationalism means that we have to become socially mature to the point where we will realize the responsibility is upon us to elevate the condition, the standard of our community to a higher level. And we can only do this by working together in harmony and unity to in some way eliminate the evils that are destroying the moral fiber of our community. Evils like drug addiction, drunkenness, illegitimacy that's brought about by loose sexual behavior, fornication, and adultery. And once we eliminate these evils that are so destructive to the moral fiber of our community, the level of our society will be higher, and you'll find that our people will be satisfied to live in our own social circles and enjoy life in our own social circles instead of trying to force our way into the social circles of those who don't want. So as I said, just as it took nationalism to bring about the independence of our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia, the goal or the objective of the political, social, and economic philosophy of black nationalism is designed to bring about the complete independence of the black people in this country by making us become consciously involved in controlling our own community. Once we can control our own communities now, then perhaps we will later be able to control our own country, control our own nation, and govern ourselves, and in some way have control over our own destiny. And in order to bring this about, the Muslim Mosque Incorporated is involved not in trying to spread any religion, but to work with people of all other religions. We will work with our people. We don't care if they are Christian or Jew or Muslim or atheist or agnostic, whatever they are. Our desire is to spread the gospel of black nationalism. We want to evangelize the gospel of black nationalism. And once this gospel of black nationalism is spread among our people, it means that those who are in the Baptist church can remain Baptist, but they take the political, economic, and social philosophy of black nationalism. Or those who are Hebrews, call themselves black Hebrews, they can still practice their religion, but take the social, political, and economic philosophy of black nationalism. And this philosophy in itself will bring about the independent thinking of the black people in this country, and eventually lead to the complete physical independence of the black people in this country.